Part 4. Society. 10. Authority. Lordship. The Empire and Social History. Holy Roman Emperors have often proved strange figures in European history. They do not seem to belong anywhere. They are constantly moving about, appearing here and there, only to disappear again, often for decades at a time. It is thus scarcely surprising that the relationship between the empire's governance and the lives of its inhabitants has remained the largest gap in its history. This relationship has often been overlooked because it was widely assumed throughout the 19th and much of the 20th century that the empire was irrelevant to its inhabitants' daily existence. The empire's transnational character has not helped, since much social history takes the nation-state as its framework, with, for example, medieval and early modern German population calculated according to 1930s frontiers and omitting political units like Burgundy that subsequently disappeared. Local and regional history also often focuses on later boundaries, as if earlier political structures had little or no impact, while the recent fashion for micro-studies has added to the difficulties of drawing general conclusions over time and space. A full social history is beyond the scope of this book. The following will not claim that the empire was some kind of cradle of European civilization, deriving from a Frankish legacy. Difference and divergence are major themes, because the empire never constituted a single homogeneous society, nor did it have a unified economy. Instead, the next three chapters will argue that the empire's political institutions and practices were rooted in society and shared its strengths and weaknesses. Political structures both expressed and conserved a society that became stratified hierarchically and structured horizontally along corporate lines. The empire held and retained meaning as the framework protecting political and social diversity. Spatial and chronological variations in the political order reflected social and economic differences. One example is the higher concentration of lords in southwest Germany and old Carolingian heartlands along the Rhine. Another example is illustrated in the differences between East and West, which owe much to the timing of migration and settlement beyond the Elbe, and the relative weakness of the intermediary level of princely authority at the point of demographic and economic change in the 15th century. Variations in the emergence of towns also relate to regional differences in political authority, as well as the readiness of emperors and lords to grant privileges. The timing of political changes was often influenced by socio-economic factors, such as the demographic growth and economic innovation, facilitating the shift from extensive to intensive lordship around 1200. The Empire and Society. Throughout, the social role of political authority was to legitimate and regulate access to and control of resources, as well as the interaction between individuals and groups. As we shall find out, how this was done changed considerably during the empire's existence. The key difference between the empire and European countries was that the former emerged as multi-centered, not just politically, but also socially, economically, and culturally. This left a lasting legacy, especially in the German lands, where these developments reached their fullest extent with imperial reform and its consequences at the local and territorial level. The result was the idea that a proper social order was composed of distinct groups and communities, each with local and specific rights. The role of authorities was to protect and nurture this society and to resolve its difficulties. The most potent form of authority in the empire was lordship, Herrschaft. Like feudalism, lordship is a highly contentious term with almost as many definitions as there are historians. The debate reflects the real problems of the sources, which reveal that medieval and early modern Europeans used a variety of words for what historians call lordship, and did so in multiple ways. The term remains useful, provided it is understood as a set of powers that could be concentrated in the hands of a single lord, but equally might become distributed between several lords, or exercised by corporate institutions or groups like city councils, religious houses, and even peasant communes. The following offers a brief chronological survey of the main socio-economic developments throughout the empire into the 18th century, while the remainder of the chapter examines the tensions between the hierarchical and associational aspects of the empire's socio-political order. Carolingian and Ottonian society. We have already heard how the empire encompassed more Romanized areas to the south and west, as well as large regions that had escaped incorporation within the ancient Roman Empire. Information on the latter regions is sparse, but it seems unlikely that what became the German kingdom was inhabited by a free warrior people holding the land in common. The majority of people during late antiquity lived in hamlets, with the few towns and larger villages restricted to the more Romanized areas like Italy. Isolated farms existed, but they belonged to the elite rather than crofters. The population relied on stock rearing. Fields were tilled individually because land was plentiful, while the small dispersed population rendered common ownership unnecessary. The few large estates worked by dependent labor were mainly in Italy. Markets were underdeveloped compared to later eras, with most activities concentrating on subsistence rather than exchange. Social difference was expressed legally in terms of free or unfree populations, rather than primarily economically. Europe's population grew by a third in the 50 years before 700 to reach 24 million, providing a powerful factor promoting the rise of the Franks, who developed a system known as villication, establishing the manorial economy to harness the greater labor power. This coincided with the development of more coherent, centralized political structures, since these could draw on the surplus production to sustain larger numbers of warriors and clergy, freed from the necessity to feed themselves. In turn, these structures provided the legal framework to command and coordinate dependent labor, since market forces alone were too weak to achieve this. Villication involved a shift to a three-field system. Instead of rotating fields annually between grass and grain, the Franks introduced a three-year cycle of winter planting, summer planting, and laying fallow. This enabled the still small population to exploit the land more intensively because they could work on different fields throughout the year. The manor developed to coordinate the workforce. Manors could be crown possessions, villae, entrusted to stewards, villici, or maiores, or could be granted as a benefice to a lay or spiritual lord, or they might be developed by lords on their own property. Each manor was centered on the lord's house, including barns and assets like mills, or specialist workshops on large manors like that at Staffelsee Abbey, employing 24 female textile workers in the early 9th century. The lord or his steward lived in the house together with servile domestics, servi dominici, or gesinde, who were maintained at the lord's expense from produce from the manor, and were employed to maintain it and work the domains, or land reserved for the lord. A typical Carolingian manor might also have 50 tenants, or live-out servants, servi casati, with farmsteads known as hides, mansi or hufa, each with 30 rods, or yokes, morgen, of land. The exact size of hides varied with soil quality, but each one generally encompassed 24 to 26 hectares. The tenants used this land to support themselves and their families, whilst also working 3 days a week to assist the domestics farming the domains. Common land, almender, formed the third part of the system, consisting of meadows, ponds, and woods, used by all the manor's inhabitants. The manorial system thus rested on the medieval concept of lordship and usage. The lord retained jurisdiction over all land associated with the manor, but only worked the domains directly, allowing tenants and others varying access to the remainder. This system spread through Carolingian conquest into Germany and, to a lesser extent, parts of Italy. Developments were interrupted by Viking, Slav, and Magyar incursions, but resumed during the late 10th century and consolidated across the next, when they also spread eastwards amongst the Slavs and Magyars through interaction with Ottonian society. Even in the 10th and 11th centuries, the bulk of production was consumed locally, with trade limited primarily to imports. Political needs remained broadly constant, as the Ottonians continued to require a socio-economic order able to supply sufficient mounted warriors for them to fight their enemies and campaign in Italy. The manorial system eroded sharp distinctions between free and unfree, creating a more complex social structure. The peasantry emerged as a hybrid group with rights associated with hides, but still dependent on a lord. Given the small population, lords were keen to retain workers and granted hereditary tenure to their peasants. But they also imposed restrictions on the sale or partition of hides to maintain them as viable subunits of the manor. Domains remained important. For example, producing four times the income derived from tenures at Cluny Abbey in the mid-12th century. Live-in domestics remained slaves into the 11th century, their numbers sustained partly by slave raiding until the late 10th century, together with requisitioning children from tenants whose own family growth remained constrained by the number of hides available. The earlier free peasantry survived better in Saxony, especially Westphalia, into the Ottonian era, but declined elsewhere in Germany with the spread of dependency, and by 1100, perhaps only 10% of the population remained legally free. The military obligations established by the Carolingians might take freemen away from their farms for months. Accepting dependency offered a way to escape this. The church was especially keen to attract labor for its large construction projects, as well as to work its lands, and frequently extended protection in return for service and a share in produce. A functional division gradually emerged to structure society into estates, or corporate social groups. The clergy and nobility were exempt from manual labor, performing spiritual and military tasks instead. The commons, or third estate, comprised the bulk of the population, providing society's material needs. Society stratified along lines of protection and service, with a clearly lordly elite sustained by peasant production. Lordship continued to develop as the legal framework to regulate this relationship through structures like manors, law courts, dioceses, and parishes. Salian and Staufer society. The mid-11th century marks a significant watershed, ending the expansion and consolidation of Frankish-Ottonian socio-economic forms and the emergence of more diversified patterns. One reason was the success of the manorial economy in raising productivity. Hunger crises persisted into the 11th century, but not on the scale of those in the 9th century, or again during the 12th. Bread had become the staple food, as evidenced by the rapid spread of watermills during the 11th century after their slow development since the Carolingian era. The more intensive field use allowed for the cultivation of more diverse crops, including vegetables that improved diet. Already, the invention of the deep-bladed plow had allowed the Franks to work the heavier northern European soil. New forms of harnessing draft animals, together with the invention of the horseshoe, improved ploughing in the 11th century, while iron axes and scythes now replaced wooden implements. Change not only came from below, but was also stimulated by lordly pressures, such as the building of stone castles and cathedrals, like that at Paderborn under Bishop Meinwald. The bishop had peasants beaten for laziness, and once had one woman dragged on her bottom across her garden until it was clear of weeds. Most lords, including counts, found the rising costs of military service could not be met from existing means, and not only pushed their peasants to be more productive, but also sought privileges like market and mint rights to help develop their lands and to gain access to cash as well as produce and labor. Europe's population rose from 38.5 million in 1000 to 73.5 million in 1340, experiencing the fastest growth in France, England, and Germany. The population of the German kingdom tripled between 1000 and 1237, rising even faster in some areas like Eastern Saxony, which saw tenfold growth. The German population grew from 8 million in the 12th century to peak at 14 million around 1300, while the number of Italians rose from around 5 million in 950 to between 7 and 8 million by 1300, at which point Hungary and the Slav areas to the east had perhaps 9.5 to 13 million inhabitants. For the most part, population growth encouraged a virtuous circle, providing more labor to boost production further. Forests were cleared in the Vosges, southwest Germany, the Palatinate, Franconia, Thuringia, Bohemia, and other upland areas during the 11th century. Improved drainage and dike construction reclaimed land along the Elbe and North Sea coasts around the early 12th century, thanks largely to the influx of migrants to these regions. Despite this, population growth increased pressure on land and so fueled urban growth, initially in Italy, where the former Roman settlements had revived already in the 10th century. And it encouraged the foundation of new towns north of the Alps after 1100. Towns stimulated more specialized production and market networks, including expanding long-distance trade. More stable relations between the Empire and Denmark and other Baltic powers encouraged such trade and contributed to a north-south division in Germany. The north was integrated within Baltic and North Sea networks through new towns founded on the coasts and along major rivers, while the south remained linked through more established towns to Mediterranean trade. Expanding markets, meanwhile, yoked North Italian towns closer to their immediate hinterlands, contributing substantially to their growing political supremacy over rural lords. In turn, towns acted as catalysts for their surrounding area, which developed market gardening and viticulture to serve the urban population, many of whom were not primarily engaged in food production. Growing commercialization increased the demand for secular vernacular literacy, as well as sharper divisions of labor and a shift from subsistence to profit. Producing for the market required new divisions of labor and more sophisticated land management than could be provided through the manorial economy. Migration to towns and further east across the Elbe caused temporary labor shortages. This added pressure on lords to offer their peasants better terms so as to encourage them to remain on their land. The process began first in Italy, where the manorial economy was never as widespread as north of the Alps, and where greater urbanization and better roads had facilitated commercialization already in the 10th century. The trend spread north during the 11th century, accelerating after 1100 and peaking around 1300. Lords moved from taking income in the form of peasants' labor to extracting it as shares of their produce through varieties of sharecropping. Italian lords soon revised this to extracting cash rents, because their tenants had greater access to urban markets to sell their produce. This became widespread during the 12th century, transforming hides into leaseholds. Meanwhile, most of the lordly domains were broken up to create additional tenancies. Short-term leases developed in Italy from the 12th century, often only lasting until the next harvest. Major operators like Cistercian monasteries, which had worked their land directly with dependent labor, also converted to leaseholds by the 14th century. Meanwhile, many peasants sublet parts of their plots to cottagers. Combined, these developments propelled further social stratification. The need for slaves evaporated with the dwindling domains, consolidating peasants as a social group commanding their own labor. However, new distinctions emerged between the rural and urban population, as well as within both. Other variations emerged through different inheritance patterns, themselves anchored in agreements with lords. Partible inheritance remained the dominant form in the German southwest, Rhineland, and parts of Franconia, but primogeniture spread elsewhere, protecting peasants from the impoverishment that often followed multiple partitions, but also distinguishing them from new groups of land-poor or landless inhabitants. More fortunate peasants used their relative wealth to buy further exemptions, for example by paying lords with candle wax rather than their labor. Lords frequently encouraged the commutation of labor services into cash dues and rents. Meanwhile, peasants acquired an incentive to develop their plots because they were free to keep any surpluses once they had paid their fixed obligations to their lord. Rents allowed more flexible forms of lordship. The lord's presence was no longer required to coordinate manorial labor, enabling him not merely to be absent, but to draw income from scattered possessions not grouped into manors. Manors became centers of lordly jurisdiction rather than economic production. Jurisdictions themselves fragmented after 1300 with the general commercialization of fiefs, since individual elements could be sold or transferred. One important element was mastery of serfs, Leibherrschaft, which declined with the contraction of directly worked estates, but persisted in some areas as the power to command labor. Even tenants and leaseholders usually remained subject to some kind of residual obligation, such as maintaining walls and roads, or providing a few days' portage each year. Other feudal elements also persisted, such as lordly restrictions on individual choice, for example marriage or freedom of movement. A second important element of lordship comprised seigneurial authority, deriving from the dominium directum, or underlining ownership of land used by tenants and leaseholders. This ensured that lord-peasant relations were never entirely dictated by economic factors. Seigneurial authority provided the legal framework to negotiate the terms of the lease, determining how far peasants could control and use their plots, as well as their protection from eviction. These powers were increasingly articulated from the 13th century as landlordship, dominus fundi, Grundherrschaft. This aspect was far more significant north of the Alps than in Italy, which largely bypassed this form through a shift directly to private written contracts with leaseholders. These contracts remained asymmetrical, especially as cities acquired jurisdiction over their rural hinterlands and imposed restrictions on the rights of leaseholders to renounce their contracts. Political interests drove these changes, because magistrates recognized that their own power depended on their ability to ensure that sufficient food reached their city's market. Judicial authority, Gerichtsherrschaft, constituted the third major form of lordly power. Population growth and economic commercialization brought overall benefits, but often at considerable individual cost, straining customary legal arrangements. the longer feudal hierarchy, and the shift to patrilinear families and more territorially based power all added to the need to demarcate jurisdictions more clearly. Jurisdiction stratified up and down the lordly hierarchy into higher and lesser authority, with important cases reserved for the former. Jurisdiction also allowed lords to maintain military authority over a population that was often no longer economically dependent upon them directly. For example, enabling senior lords to summon their vassal tenants to help fulfill their own obligations, including those to the emperor. The 14th century crisis. The trends of the Salian and Staufer eras continued into the early 14th century, further underscoring the point made earlier that the Staufer's demise was personal rather than structural. Nonetheless, high politics continued to make a social impact. The rivals for the German crown after 1250 granted immunities and privileges to lords and towns to win their support, while relative royal weakness provided more scope for local initiatives in revising existing legal and social arrangements. Meanwhile, economic growth slowed during the late 13th century, as rising lordly demands on peasants combined with the still growing population to encourage renewed subdivision of tenancies in many areas. Between half and three quarters of peasant farms in northern Burgundy and southwest Germany were reduced to only 3 to 5 hectares. Unfortunately, adverse climatic conditions set in, with colder, wetter weather around 1300, damaging harvests and causing famine in parts of Germany between 1309 and 1311, with further problems thereafter. All normal activities and concerns were suspended as the malnourished population fell victim to the Black Death, which killed around 60% of inhabitants from 1348 to 1350. This was not a solitary cataclysm. The plague returned with virtually every subsequent generation into the 15th century, with some outbreaks actually even worse, such as that in Bohemia in 1379 to 1380. This slowed the recovery, so that the total population around 1470 was still a quarter below that in 1347. The mortality crisis triggered the 14th century recession, characterized by the rapid contraction in settled areas, with, for example, 1,000 square kilometers lost to the North Sea, where flood defenses were no longer maintained. Less fertile or accessible areas were either abandoned or given over to meadows, pasturage, or the steady spread of reforestation. Those areas with better soil were now worked even more intensively, since this offered the best returns on the available labor. The result was accelerated market specialization and exchange, since localities were less able to provide all their needs directly. A more diversified economic landscape emerged. Mixed husbandry and arable farming predominated, because animal manure increased and prolonged soil fertility. Such areas often clustered around towns, which provided markets for meat. Meanwhile, population decline reduced the demand for grain and left more for animal feed. Viticulture expanded along the Moselle, Rhine, Main, Saale, Unstrut, Rhone, and Po rivers, and in other parts of Italy. The population recovery accelerated this by providing the labor required by viticulture. Some areas developed crops for manufacturing, notably wool in Saxony and flax in Swabia. Rural industry also grew where there were good mineral deposits, notably salt mining in Austria, Bavaria, and parts of the Alps, as well as silver and other ore extraction in the Tyrol, Harz, and parts of Saxony. Bohemian glass manufacture also acquired an international reputation in this period. The relative rapidity of these changes proved deeply disturbing, though their exact connection with heightened violence in the 14th and 15th centuries remains controversial. Lordship was certainly hard hit as land values crashed, for instance, falling in the county of Namur by between a quarter and a half. Population decline increased labor's scarcity and bargaining power. Tenants negotiated lower rents and dues, while those in Bavaria and Franconia secured hereditary tenure. The trend towards a landless proletariat was now reversed as former day laborers gained access to tenancies. The few lords still farming with dependent serfs now stopped this practice, while wages became more widely available to attract and retain workers. Weaker lords generally fared worst, like the knights and mediate vassals with small fiefs, who often sought alternative employment as princely retainers and administrators, thereby consolidating both the longer lordly hierarchy and the territorialization of princely power. Where possible, lords used existing elements of servitude to invent new taxes, such as emigration fees, marriage licenses, and death duties, though their overall burden eased with the economic recovery after 1470. Thanks to accumulated capital, towns and individual burghers were often well placed to profit in these conditions, buying land or investing in viticulture around their town. Urban artisans also benefited from higher wages. Towns and burghers bought or mortgaged lordly rights, accelerating the fragmentation of lordship into different kinds of jurisdiction that could be shared or held by multiple owners. Overall, this process prevented the development of a uniform society of subjects sharing a common relationship to authority in the empire. Growth and diversity in early modernity. The initial recovery paradoxically produced the late medieval agrarian depression around 1350 until 1470. Land was slowly reoccupied after 1370 and production increased, especially as harvest yields also improved. Despite periodic famine years like 1437 to 1438, grain prices fell to a long-term low in the mid-15th century. Social and geographic mobility resumed in the mid-14th century, but slowed again around 1400, until the rapid and sustained demographic recovery between 1470 and 1530. By 1560, the population in most areas matched early 14th century levels, and in some places continued to rise until a renewed slowdown around 1580, with the onset of the renewed colder, wetter weather of the Little Ice Age. The Thirty Years' War, 1618 to 1648, reduced the empire's population by a fifth, primarily by magnifying the impact of renewed plague. The rate of recovery was slowed by renewed warfare after 1672, but restored to 1618 levels around 1710, while renewed and sustained growth set in around 1730. Middling principalities like Brunswick and Württemberg now saw annual growth rates of 6 to 7%, rising to 10% in Brandenburg. Bavaria was the only major territory to experience marginal population decline across the 18th century. The total for the empire, including Burgundy, but excluding Imperial Italy, rose from around 20 million in 1700 to over 29 million in 1800, with perhaps another 5 million in Imperial Italy. Population density was far higher than in Habsburg and Hohenzollern territory outside the empire, which together held another 12.6 million people in 1800. Food prices rose 250% across 1500 to 1800, whereas real wages fell by up to a half. The discrepancy worsened in the second half of the 18th century, when rising population caused food prices to rise up to six times faster than wages. Crop failures precipitated serious subsistence crises during 1755 to 1762, 1770 to 1774 and 1787 to 1789. Systemic underemployment set in by the later 18th century, with a quarter of the population living precariously and 5 to 10% displaced to a life on the roads. The extent to which development diverged along the River Elbe remains one of the most controversial aspects of European history, since it lent itself to ideological distinctions between Western democracy and Eastern autocracy. It is clear that different trends set in during the 15th century, producing what has been labeled a second serfdom east of the Elbe. This entailed the re-emergence of bonded, dependent labor working large manorial estates. Its roots lay in the impact of the 14th century crisis, which proved far more serious in the East, because peasants had fewer opportunities to profit from their temporarily increased labor value. There were fewer towns, and market networks were less well developed compared to those in the West. As grain prices continued to fall, only large-scale production remained profitable, especially where it had access along rivers to ports able to ship bulk cargoes to feed the more urbanized markets of northwestern Europe. Lesser lords in the East were also better placed relative to princes than their Western counterparts, given the less dense and flatter lordly hierarchy. Princes east of the Elbe relied on knights and mediate vassals to govern the more dispersed rural population and had granted more land as mediate fiefs. Compared to that in the West, the imperial church was a smaller and more recent creation east of the Elbe and less able to provide alternative employment to lesser lords or to act as a possible support for princes. Altogether, the eastern regions remained distant from the king, who played a less significant role in promoting local developments through charters and immunities. Consequently, knights in the east of the empire had greater opportunities to acquire concentrated and extensive jurisdictions. In particular, they were often able to use the institutions of the nascent territorial administrations to their advantage. For example, through imposing wage limits and tighter supervision of the rural population. Mastery of serfs was revived to secure labor for a new form of manorial economy, Gutwirtschaft, based on a large landed estate, Gut, operating a monoculture of grain production for export. This developed in Schleswig, Holstein, Mecklenburg, Pomerania, Brandenburg, Bohemia, and to a lesser extent in parts of Austria, as well as outside the empire in Poland and Hungary. In fact, relatively few Eastern lords truly fit the model of the Junker agrarian capitalist, while perhaps only 10% of grain production was exported through long-distance Baltic trade. Other forms of production and land use continued. Nonetheless, the development of the new manorial economy helped to distinguish regions east of the Elbe as one of several major socio-economic areas in the early modern empire. Likewise, political as well as economic factors provided particular characteristics in the Western Empire. As we shall find out, territorial authorities expanded their regulation of daily life in the interest of moral, religious, and fiscal agendas. Farms became fiscal as well as economic units, with mid-15th century Bavarian edicts already distinguishing core plots that could not be partitioned at inheritance. Leases generally became hereditary, while labor service continued to decline relative to cash rents and increasingly also taxes. Sharecropping persisted in Italy, though better conditions emerged in the Po Valley. In contrast to France and elsewhere, German lords west of the Elbe retained very little land under their direct control, allowing peasants access to the bulk of the cultivated area. Princely domains already only accounted for 15% of cultivated land in Austria and Lower Bavaria in the later Middle Ages. The proportion in Bavaria shrank to 13.2% by the late 18th century, while nobles owned 34%, clergy 56%, urban corporations 0.4%, and freeholding peasants only 4%. However, these rates refer to underlying dominium directum, not rights of usage, that allowed Bavarian peasants access to over 90% of land through leases. Even east of the Elbe, the situation was not wholly unfavorable. The Prussian king held only 4.5% of the agricultural land, with nobles owning and directly managing 11%, and cities and foundations a further 4.5%. Peasants had access to the remaining 80% as plots tied to manors or through leases. Control remained political rather than immediately economic. The Bavarian elector was direct lord of only 10.6% of peasants, but held lesser as well as superior legal jurisdiction over a further 55.9%, while the clergy and nobility were lords of the rest. Defining the common good: fellowship and lordship. The social changes around 1100 contributed to the slow emergence of horizontal associational fellowship, Genossenschaft, alongside vertical lordship. These two forms of social organization need to be treated carefully, as it is easy to assign them clear ideological distinctions. Much of German history has been seen as a struggle between the two, before, depending on the viewpoint, either their synthesis in modern society or the triumph of authoritarianism. The empire often takes the blame for the outcome, as apparently weak central power supposedly allowed the population to be oppressed by a multitude of petty princes, Duoditzfürsten, who were already satirized in the 18th century. Friedrich Schiller's play, Kabbalah und Liebe, depicts a prince selling his subjects as mercenaries to fund a luxurious lifestyle. The standard contrast with powerful monarchs like Louis XIV, or Prussia's Frederick II, the Great, makes these princes appear even more ridiculous. The polemical potential was not lost on 19th-century German liberals, who regarded the principalities surviving beyond 1806 as the primary obstacles to national unification. We need to remove the moral signs and not simplify the situation as a clash between progressive, proto-democratic fellowship and reactionary lordship. Associational and communal forms were not exclusive to peasants and burghers, but were important to clergy and nobles, as we shall find out, while communes could also be lords. Lordship and fellowship did not merely coexist, but were closely interdependent. Above all, the ideology of the common good, like government techniques, was not simply pioneered by citizens, only to be stolen later by princes. Instead, hierarchical and horizontal forms worked in creative tension, producing new ideas and practices. Communities contained associational and hierarchical elements, and not all inhabitants regarded lords as outsiders. Most recognized that communities require leaders. These were not temporary faces in the crowd, striding forward at the right moment, but were generally established figures with the social and political capital necessary for leadership. Arguments rarely divided people purely according to wealth, and instead provided an extensive political vocabulary employed across the social spectrum. What united rulers and ruled was their engagement in the same debate over the ideal community. Core values like peace, justice, and harmony were related to morality and Christianity, and were thus considered timeless and authentic. Although all three were contested in practice, a fourth, Notdurft, proved the most controversial. Its ambiguities are revealed by its two possible translations of sustenance and necessity. The former implied entitlement to the material means of existence, potentially including social leveling to ensure at least minimum shares for all. This could operate as a kind of moral economy, criticizing exploitation, hoarding, and price rigging, thereby providing a basis to reject excessive lordly demands. However, it also suggested a moral obligation to ensure sustenance, adding force to the idea of necessity overriding established arrangements in the name of the greater good. The distinction between common good, salus publica, or Gemeinnutz, and self-interest, Eigennutz, was already well established during the early Middle Ages, and it sharpened with the wider appreciation of the contribution of the third estate to general well-being. The term common man emerged by 1280 as a largely positive appellation, while ordinary folk were celebrated in illuminated manuscript books and cathedral carvings and windows, all depicting the Christian ideal of serving the community. The basic antithesis between common and private good persisted into the late 18th century and in many ways beyond, despite subtle changes in how it was expressed. The development of natural law from the 17th century argued that authority rested on a social contract in which the population surrendered some of their natural freedoms in return for the benefits of living in an orderly society. Questions of authority. The crucial question remained: who was entitled to define the common good, and thus to set the normative measures intended to foster and preserve it? Additionally, what limits could be imposed on that authority, and what recourse did the subordinate population have against its abuse? Medieval writers remained fixed on the person of the king, rather than princes or lesser lords, but the articulation of good kingship was easily transferable to other authorities, especially as these acquired clearer public functions during the period of imperial reform. Numerous texts identified the prince as responsible for the bonum commune. These retained the earlier moral emphasis, but now devoted more space to judging policies rather than personal characteristics. They contributed to the growing articulation around 1500 of the imperial estates as authorities, Obrigkeiten, governing subjects, Untertanen. Attempts during the Reformation to re-theologize the language of the common good failed, especially as the political outcome expanded the powers of imperial estates to supervise church and religious life. The Peace of Westphalia and subsequent political discussion defined the imperial estates more clearly as possessing territorial sovereignty, Landeshoheit, which became the collective term for the bundle of accumulated rights sanctioned by imperial law. Clearer ideas of authority gained ground with the fiscal and military needs of the later 17th and 18th centuries, which encouraged further intervention in daily life to promote thrift, obedience, and productivity. It was accompanied by a change in style, most noticeable among the princes, but also apparent in the imperial cities, where the magistrates became more patrician and aristocratic. Already around the mid-16th century, princes remodeled their castles or built new residences to present carefully crafted images of power. Whereas the castles of medieval lords might suggest they feared attack from their subjects, the unfortified Baroque palace exuded confident authority. Language changed too, as the word common became more ambiguous. Common man lost its positive associations in the wake of the violence of the Peasants' War, 1524-1526, and became the antithesis of noble, edel, while common woman denoted a prostitute. The language of consensus persisted into the 16th century, with rulers being gracious, gnädig, in negotiating with their loyal subjects, getreue Untertanen. However, these terms were increasingly displaced in the ruler's discourse by words emphasizing his power to command. Befehl, Gehorsam, Respekt, Hoheit, Autorität. Princes simultaneously stressed their personal honor and reputation, which were now measured by the prince's place in the imperial hierarchy and his international standing. The experience of the Thirty Years' War allowed princes to employ the argument of necessity to justify emergency measures. The official commemoration of the war through annual religious services and processions gave thanks for deliverance from horror, but simultaneously blamed the calamity on the sins of the pre-war population, who had allegedly incurred God's wrath. Religious services and government mandates repeatedly admonished subjects to be pious, dutiful, thrifty, and obedient, all as means to ensure the horrors of war would not return. The cumulative result was a more absolutist style and conception of rule, elevating the prince above his subjects. Only he, it was claimed, could see beyond individual selfish interests to govern in the common good. Thanks to its roots in the public functions defining the status of imperial estate, absolutism developed at this level, including for Austria and Prussia, rather than for the empire overall in the person of the emperor. Imperial absolutism remained only a specter conjured through the rhetoric of German liberties to oppose tighter Habsburg management of the empire. Absolutism was distinguished from arbitrary rule by the restriction of absolute authority to within certain limits. All discussion of princely power acknowledged imperial law and the empire as part of these limits. The spread of enlightened ideas provided new arguments to support official direction of public life, especially through the utilitarian critique of received traditions, adding weight to the language of necessity to disregard existing arrangements if deemed obsolete. Historians dispute how far such ideas actually changed princely rule. Style certainly changed, as rulers consciously distanced themselves from the Renaissance and Baroque celebration of the prince as a semi-divine heroic ruler in favor of appearing more modestly as the state's first servant, signally by the fashion for wearing simple military uniform rather than the pearl-buttoned silk coats and giant wigs of the recent past. In some respects, rule became even more personal than before. Despite presenting himself as Prussia's first servant, Frederick the Great tried to master all business himself, conducting government from his cabinet or writing desk, rather than like other princes through formal meetings with counselors. Overall, however, government became more impersonal. Emperor Joseph II, himself a near parody of the pre-revolutionary cult of the first servant, established in his law code of 1787 that crimes were now understood to be against the state, allowing the authorities to prosecute, even if no plaintiff came forward.